So tailings are dangerous because essentially they're kind of these ticking time bombs that are left behind and that at any moment can start polluting or have already started polluting the environment around them.
Good afternoon, and I guess by you it's good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Hassan.
Yeah, it's good evening almost, given it's our winters, it's already dark at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Now we're in summer, so we have daylight until 9 p.m. now.
We, of course, over the past year, we've been trying to work together on tailings. We will talk about that. But can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Who are you and how did you end up working in this field?
Sure, yeah.
And of course, work for Earthworks. And who are you guys?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Jan Morrill, and I'm the tailings campaign manager at Earthworks. Earthworks we're a U.S.-based organization that works to support communities on the front lines of extraction projects and look for sustainable solutions. So we work with communities that are facing oil, natural gas, and hard rock mining projects, both in the United States and abroad. And so I work specifically on issues related to the dangers that mine waste poses for downstream communities and ecosystems for hard rock mining projects. And this work is kind of twofold. It is providing direct support to communities that are being affected by mining projects and helping them in advocacy campaigns or elevate, you know, their struggles into international spaces, but we also do work on policy. So what are best practices around mine waste storage? How do we make it safer? What do communities need for it to be safer? And how do we advocate for changes both in the United States and internationally? And I came to this work through an experience of organizing with communities in El Salvador. I lived for 5 years in Central America and El Salvador. And I was working with communities that were struggling to pass the first ever ban on metallic mining. And so I helped create international connections between the social movement to ban mining in El Salvador and their international partners. And El Salvador became the first country to ban all metallic mining in a number of years ago. So that's how I kind of got involved in this work, was through community support. And then I moved into this Earthworks.
So you come as an expert.
I come as an expert in working with communities that are opposing mining. I'm not a technical expert. I don't have a degree in geology or geophysics, but I do have a long history of working with communities who are fighting to protect their water and their air and have a healthy environment.
This combination between mass action and technical knowledge is, I think you've crafted your skills in that. Very much the kind of work that we are doing also here at Benchmarks Foundation when we work with mining communities. Now, but Earthworks, they work in more than just tailings, no?
Yeah, so we have a number of different work areas. So we work, for example, with communities in the United States that are either trying to stop proposed mines or trying to have access to remedy for damages caused by mines. We do policy work in the United States around mining law. I have colleagues that do work internationally around issues related to free and prior informed consent. We are supporting the call for a moratorium on deep sea mining. I have colleagues that work on the connections between the environmental and social impacts created by mining and the push to create electric vehicles and the problems that we push towards a greener economy could create if we keep mining in the same ways. So we work on a whole host of issues, but I just focus specifically on tailing stamps.
Okay. Before we get into the detail of a report that we launched, South Africa was the host country that Earthworks and Mining Watch Canada basically launched with us, with FSE and ourselves. The question that I wanted to raise, what excited me about this work And I don't know whether you can get the word excitement in with tailings. I don't know if you can put them together, but
that's a hard sell.
Yeah, but the idea has been that for me, the way I see it, the tailings proposals or the standards we recommend are so far reaching that they touch on communities' rights to refuse where tailings should be put. So there's a democratic element. The other part of democracy there is that there must be free, prior, informed consent. People need to be told, they need to be resourced. They may be able to call on experts to help them. You know, so that's the democracy aspect. But there's also the aspect that the people can organize around this waste, and they could, if they're unhappy, go to the authorities, if you like, you know, and demand, if you like, that this be transparent and there be greater accountability. And we're not allowing the bosses, if you like, to simply decide that this is good enough on their own. So there's an element of power that emerges there. There's a need for redress, you know, I mean, that profit is not the motive. You know, I mean, yeah, so I find this quite useful, and you and I have discussed it. We think we could work on a lovely toolkit later on. But in terms of values and principles, are you in agreement that these have a great potential to empower citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's an important piece, because I think communities affected by mining historically have been very disempowered. So mining companies are oftentimes supported by governments and come in and impose projects that really don't benefit the people who are most directly affected by them. And so I think it's really important to look for tools and ways that we can empower communities to take back control over their well-being and livelihoods, essentially. You know, mining is one of the most polluting industries in the entire world. You know, air, water, soil, that leads to health impacts on both humans and the surrounding environment. And so we really try at Earthworks, and I think you're right, Hassan, that this is the important piece of the work, to look to ways to empower the people that are most impacted to be able to advocate for changes to improve their lives and livelihood. And part of that is giving communities the right to say no to particularly dangerous projects. And then part of it is, and it's a core principle of what Earthworks advocates for. And then part of it is looking for ways to build resources like this report or tools that communities can use to advocate with their governments and the people that are regulating the mining industry to make sure that there are changes so that things either improve or don't continue to get worse.
I mean, for us, we believe that the mining law, yeah, the MPRDA it's called, excludes the opinions of communities from the air, from observing how licenses are issued. They're not factored in. And I think it's the nature of how capitalist mining generally operates. The communities are just the place where you externalize the cost, not really to include them. I don't know in first world countries whether this is much different.
I think it's a problem across the board in countries all over the world. So for example, in the United States and Canada, there have been long-standing struggles from particularly Indigenous communities who are the most impacted by mining projects to be able to exercise their right for free, prior, and informed consent. And oftentimes, you know, we've seen over the course of history how Indigenous rights have been trampled on by mining companies and how they have not been able to defend their resources in their territories. And I think, you know, I think an important piece of that is that often governments are either unwilling or unable to regulate the mining industry. Unwilling because there's regulatory capture where the mining industry is part of the government agencies or funding part of the government agencies or funding national universities and other institutions that could be independent checks on the industry.
In our part of the world, bringing foreign direct investment.
Exactly.
You know, and the use of threat, yeah.
Exactly. And it happens here in the United States as well, where government agencies really see themselves as promoting and regulating the mining industry instead of really providing accountability and oversight to protect communities. So I think that's a really important piece of it, too, is that that you were mentioning is that governments don't always either have the capacity or the will to really do effective oversight of the mining industry.
Let us start on this second edition of a phenomenal report. It's called Safety First. Tell us, how did it come about?
Sure. So we at Earthworks have been working on issues related to tailings and the dangers that tailings management pose for a very long time, as have our partners at Mining Watch Canada and the London Mining Network, who are also co-authors of this report. And what we've seen historically over time is that all the guidelines and standards and regulations that are being developed to supposedly protect and promote safety don't go far enough to really rein in the most dangerous mining practices and ensure, like we were just talking about, that communities are empowered in the process to defend and protect their environment and livelihoods. So we started to think, you know, from a civil society perspective, working with frontline communities and Indigenous peoples and labor unions, like what are the issues that are the most important from that perspective to really start to push for progressive and positive changes in tailings management. And so we started having these conversations about what needs to be done, how can we make things move towards safer practices. And through those conversations, we began to develop this report that was Safety First. We released the first version of the report in June of 2020, so about 2 years ago. And after we released it, we outlined 16 guidelines that from our perspective were important to really stop the most dangerous practices, make sure that there was respect for communities and hold mining companies accountable. And after we released that report into the world, we got a lot of amazing feedback from affected communities, from Indigenous peoples, from technical experts saying, we love your report, but here's how we think it could be better. So last year, we underwent a process of regional consultations on five continents in, I believe, four languages with about 200 participants, really asking people. So like from your perspective on the ground, where you live, what do you think needs to happen to make tailings safer? And then we compiled all of that information and we just released the report, as you mentioned, with you all in South Africa. It'll be 3 weeks ago now, at the end of May.
Let us help our listeners here and our viewers. Simply put, what are tailings?
Yeah, so I like to think of tailings as trash, right? Tailings are the trash of the mining process. And it's one of the forms of mine waste where you have a combination of crushed rock, water, and then chemicals that are used during the processing of the ore. And so basically it's what's left over after the metal that is being mined is extracted from the rock that was taken out of the ground. And tailings are usually stored behind dams that are structures that are made out of mine waste and other tailings themselves.
So if you look at Johannesburg and you see or the Greater Vaal Reef, which is the Witwatersrand Reef, mm-hmm. you have a lot of mine dumps. We are a 150-year-old mining town, if you like, South Africa. Would that constitute tailings as well, the yellow sand that's a mountain?
So tailings, you know, there's many different types of mine waste. I believe that the dumps around Johannesburg are tailings dumps. And, you know, I think something that's important to remember, you know, building off what you just said, is that the other thing is that those are permanent structures, right? So you have 150 years of mining history in South Africa. Those tailings dams have been there since the beginning, and they're going to continue in perpetuity, because when a mine closes, they don't pack up the tailings and move them away, or they don't decommission the dam. They leave that dam there basically forever. And the surrounding communities then have to deal with the consequences of that.
Well, you know, during the months of August, really our windy months, people's homes are filled in this area near Soweto, really. Soweto area, Meadowlands and others, they're filled with sand going mm-hmm. to their homes. Many kids complain of asthma and stuff like that. So clearly they have life even long after the bosses have gone. Mm-hmm. But tell us, so why should we take tailings seriously? I mean, I think we're entering that area. Why are they dangerous? What risks do they pose? You know, and you know, what are the failings, the tailings facilities becoming more and more dangerous? And, you know, what are the danger points that we should be looking out for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a couple important points in this question. Tailings dams are dangerous for a number of reasons. They're dangerous because, like I mentioned, mine waste tailings will contain the chemicals that are used during the processing of the minerals. So sometimes that's cyanide, for example, or other chemicals that are then stored there. But also, you know, when you have a mine, for example, a gold mine, when they dig up the ore body, the mining company often is only extracting gold or maybe gold and silver or a couple different metals. But the ore body itself has many, many different types of heavy metals. And those aren't the company that isn't aiming to extract those. So those are left behind. And they can leach out with over time if they're exposed to rain and air. Those can leach out. And then you have heavy metal contamination. Or like you were saying with dust, those heavy metals are in the dust particles and then they're blowing through the air. So tailings are dangerous because essentially they're kind of these ticking time bombs that are left behind and that at any moment can start polluting or have already started polluting the environment around them. Another reason tailings are dangerous is because they're some of the largest man-made structures on the face of the earth, right? So there are tailings dams that are almost 200 meters tall. There are tailings dams you can see from space. And like we mentioned, they don't just pack them up and move it when mining ends. But because the dam that is made to retain the tailings is often made out of mine waste and leftover tailings, it can be really susceptible to collapsing, to eroding over time. And if water builds up behind the dam, it can collapse very suddenly and have what's called a catastrophic failure, where all the tailings or much of the tailings are released and start flowing downstream. And so a really horrific example of this in recent history was in 2019 in Brumadinho, Brazil, a tailings dam failed. It released 9.7 million cubic meters of waste turned into a landslide that flowed downhill and killed 272 people that lived below the dam, as well as workers that were present at the mine site.
And of course, livelihoods and homes and histories, dams more than that.
Exactly, and polluted a river. They tend to be near water sources. And so then people who are fishing, that their livelihood is fishing, or who planted crops along the side of the river, now that river is completely contaminated. So there's a number of, there can be like long-term slow pollution that can happen, or there can be these really catastrophic accidents. And it's also really important because research has shown that tailings dams are failing with increased frequency and severity. So we're having more failures and they're becoming worse. And some of the factors that lead into that are, you know, we've got larger volumes of waste that are being stored because ore grades are declining. We've got companies that are looking to maximize their profits and therefore are decreasing their investment in safety. And we've got climate change. So we've got more erratic weather patterns. We've got more water coming and piling behind tailings dams. And so it's making kind of this like perfect storm to push us towards really dangerous situations.
Yeah. I mean, you have a number of examples beyond Brumadinho. I mean, of course, we have the South African one, but do you want to give us some examples of where these damages have been caused in other parts of the world, maybe just one or two?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the biggest ones in recent history besides Brumadinho was in Brazil, very close to the Brumadinho accident, there was a failure in Mariana at the San Marco mine. And this was actually called the worst environmental disaster in Brazilian history, where again, millions and millions of cubic meters of mine waste were released. The tailings flowed 600 kilometers to the Atlantic Ocean. So just like hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of destruction. They covered entire towns. And it was really, really devastating. Another example is 2014 in Canada, actually. So, you know, a country that supposedly has strong mining regulations. There was a tailings dam failure at the Mount Polley mine that again released millions of cubic meters of waste and destroyed some really important salmon habitats, contaminated a local lake, and really impacted Indigenous people's territory where they were dependent on the natural resources for their livelihoods and survival. So there's been, you know, examples in countries in the global north just as much as there's been examples of countries in the global south.
But we would always believe that you guys have tighter regulation than we have.
That's a common misconception that, and it's promoted by the mining industry, right? So the mining industry says, look, we have these great regulations in the United States and Canada and Australia, and therefore we have everything under control. The United States, our mining law is from 1872. Our mining law is 150 years old. It has gaping holes in it in terms of protections for safety, for environmental issues, for even for things like taxes and funds for local governments around the mining industry. That's, it's not, the US and Canada are not leading on mining regulation.
Yeah, but I mean, before we move on, we had our own disaster, the Zululand anthracite colliery, you know, the coal mine in KwaZulu-Natal, where 1.5 million liters of polluted mine waste burst from its slurry dam, and it was on Christmas Eve, you know, and clearly the heavy rains, it was already the beginning of the heavy rains, and it just burst open, and, you know, it was, and this was dealt with, it was 2021, and January, the community, if you like, were the last to be informed what was happening. So clearly some of these pointers here are some of the things that you guys are addressing in the recommendations, you know? So let me just go on about, I mean, if a dam could damage the tailings facility, the tailings dam, clearly there must be a problem where it is built, where this water is coming from, or from the mountains, heavy rains, whatever, it affected animal life, the works, and the nature reserve. So you guys have an issue about where dams are supposed to be located, no?
Yeah, so this is a really important point, is that if a failure at a tailings dam would create some sort of unacceptable risk to downstream communities or important watersheds, then it shouldn't be built in that location. There needs to be consideration of the distance between communities or important natural resources and tailings dams, because like we said, they last forever. And so if a mining company is not going to be able to maintain and monitor their tailings dam forever, then there needs to be some sort of consideration before it's built about the resources that are around it. And so one of the things we say in the report is that there needs to be a study done, and that communities and local governments need to decide together whether the risk of the tailings dam is acceptable. And there are certain things that, certain places where tailings dams just shouldn't be built ever. And communities and governments need to have the right, or communities specifically need to have the right to decide where those are.
Yeah. I mean, how many tailings dams are there in the world? Is there any inventory or some record keeping? Who are the parties that we have to engage with? I mean, we can say the bosses and that. Can our work be made easier? Is the ICMM up to the task? I mean, they've got their own standards. How do we engage them in this challenge to make sure that lives are saved?
Yeah, it's really actually surprising that there's no global inventory of tailings dams in the world. So we don't know how many there are. The estimates that researchers give are between 20 and 30,000 scattered across the globe. Some of them are at active mines, some of them are abandoned. You know, the mines have closed up long ago and there's a tailings dam there and no one's really paying attention to it anymore. Just in the United States, we have hundreds of thousands of abandoned mines, but there's no system for tracking them. And right now there's an initiative that's being organized by the Church of England's pension fund and investors that are part of Principles for Responsible Investment to create a database But it's very early days. It's only got, I think it's got like about 1500 registered tailings dams, and it's all self-reported. So it's really relying on mining companies to give this information over. One thing that we've seen a lot is that mining companies don't like to share that information very often. And mining companies don't even like to share information about things that are critical to safety, like when a tailings dam fails. So like with the example you were giving of the recent failure in South Africa, the community didn't even know. And oftentimes there will be failures at tailings dams, and mining companies will not tell anyone. They won't tell the government, or they won't tell the communities. And so one of the things that we say in Safety First, in our guideline around access to information, is that mining companies have to report publicly every time that there's a tailings dam failure, how much tailings are released, what are the potential impacts, and everything that they know about it.
So here's the thing then. There are about 16, a dozen and some odd recommendations that we should be struggling over. And there's a question about how we as a movement can use this to improve our lives. What do the authors think? We will go later to what these principles are or action points. But what was your intention when you met with other experts and activists? How do they want this report to be used?
Yeah, so we're really hoping that this report can be a tool for communities, for Indigenous peoples, Indigenous nations, for workers, for frontline NGOs to advocate with their governments, with their regulatory bodies, maybe with the mining companies themselves, to improve safety. So we think that it's important that, like we talked about earlier, you and I, that communities have access to the resources that they need to effectively demand changes. And so we hope that, you know, the 17 guidelines that are in the report can kind of help communities figure out what are the things that we want to work on in our local context, or what are the things that we want to address here. And so
you're not saying to a community that all of them apply equally to every community.
I mean, there might be instances where something's not relevant. So, for example, we say that mines should not be, or tailings dams should not be used, should not be built using a specific type of construction method, which is called the upstream construction method. But that's been banned in Ecuador and Chile and parts of Brazil. So communities in those areas that's not going to be relevant for them, because that's not something that they have to deal with necessarily. But they might really want to use the guideline around access to technical assistance, for example.
So it is really a toolkit that they can take what is applicable, you know. And of course, as we discussed earlier, it's a democratizing campaign model that people can use where applicable. Yeah,
exactly.
So that's how you guys saw it then. So we agree on that.
But I would just add that in terms of, because there's a lot of standards that have been developed around tailings management by the mining industry or by other international bodies. And we do say that any standard that's developed that's intended to be comprehensive, if it doesn't include all 17 of the guidelines that we've outlined, it's not good enough. It's not going far enough. It's not protective enough. So while communities can kind of pick and choose based on their local realities what pieces make the most sense for them, internationally, policy-wise, industry-wise, everything needs to be included.
But that's interesting, because you say industry-wide, but who are the standard bearers of this? Is it the UN, or who maintains that? Because the corporate lobby is so powerful, even within the UN.
Yeah. Yeah, so after the Brumadinho tailings failure in 2019, there was a process that was formed called the Global Tailings Review, and it was co-convened by the United Nations Environmental Program, by Principles for Responsible Investment, which is this group of investors that are interested in this issue, and then by the ICMM, which is the Mining Industry Trade Association. Yeah, and through that process, they developed what's called the Global Industry Standard on Tailings Management. So it is, you know, it's the first of its kind global tailings standard. We compared it to Safety First, and it definitely falls short on a lot of the recommendations and guidelines that we have. Also, we were disappointed that a lot of the participation during the public comment periods of civil society groups was not taken into account in the final draft. So we think that the standard really doesn't go far enough, but this was the first kind of attempt and iteration at global management.
Maybe, I mean, for the time that we have left, maybe you should try and run us through some of these principles, and hopefully, time permitting, we will look at a concrete example. Just we can pick up one from our the groups we work with, just to see how they apply. Let's kick off. So what is the first one, clearly?
Well, so there's 17 kind of, there's 17 guidelines, and maybe what I'll do is break them down into like buckets.
But Jen, you made a promise to each other that we're going to try and group them later on into families of rights, not in this discussion.
No.
Today it's very important for us to understand them on their own merits, but later on we will get them into families of, siblings coming together.
Sure.
You know, to say these are the more democratic ones, these are the ones fighting for redress, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Right.
But
yeah.
You're the expert.
Kind of like some overarching areas. So that one overarching area is that like communities need to be empowered and have their rights respected. So we have a guideline that says that communities must provide consent for any tailings facility over the life of that mine. So that means communities have the right to say no if they don't want a tailings facility to be built, or they have the right to say yes if they think that it's appropriate. That process for determining consents is often manipulated by mining companies. So we say that it needs to be free of external manipulation, coercion, and extortion. It needs to be conducted with all affected communities in the relevant languages that they speak and respecting their cultural norms. And that that communities have the right at any moment to kind of revoke that consent if they decide that the tailings dam is too risky. We also say that communities need to be involved in emergency response planning. So from the beginning of the construction of the tailings dam, because if there is a catastrophic failure, communities need to know both what to do and they need to have been part of the process to decide their response so that it's an appropriate response.
Just let me intervene there. It is almost like a no-brainer. These are the people who are going to die.
Exactly.
Why exclude them? In their own lives.
Exactly. And it's kind of shocking how little mining companies involve communities. For example, there's a mine in the United States where we heard that they were considering where they're going to expand their tailings dam. And so they had to create an emergency response plan. And so they held a public meeting and they said, this is the emergency response plan. And they gave everybody magnets to put on their fridge of like, if there's a tailings failure, make sure to get evacuated. Like, that's not appropriate. That's not co-designing a plan with the community to show up afterwards.
I thought the magnet was part of the response team.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, that's it seems like a no-brainer, but it's almost never really being done in a true way where communities have the power to like make decisions and make recommendations and have them.
I stopped you and I don't want to do that because we have to come back. It seems like there's a priority around profits, but I'm sure it will come through some of your recommendations.
Yeah. But just lastly, kind of on the community respect for community piece, we have a guideline saying that communities need access to information. Mining companies oftentimes aren't providing accurate or up-to-date or sufficient information, and communities need to be able to know what's happening. We also say that communities should have access to technical assistance. So when you get these documents, sometimes communities have the internal capacity or people have the internal capacity to read the documents. Sometimes they don't because it's, you know, geophysics or it's engineering or it's any of the things, right? So we say that communities should be able to request independent technical experts to help them understand the information.
And it's paid for by the corporations, I guess, or by the government.
Yeah, we say that it should be paid by the mining company, but that the communities or the local organizations should pick the experts themselves. So the mining company can't be the expert, but they should pay for it.
I like it, yeah.
And then lastly, we say that there should be mechanisms in place for grievances. So if the company is doing something that the community or workers or anyone that's affected by the mine feels is inappropriate or is dangerous, there should be a way for people to complain about that, and that that process should be independent of the company. It shouldn't just be you complain to someone and they internally and they.
So like the Human Rights Commission or some ombuds office or but.
Or like a third party firm that's paid for by the company, something like that. Yep.
But not controlled by the company.
Not controlled, but it needs to be functionally independent. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then going to your point about profits. So one of the first guideline is that, you know, safety needs to be the guiding principle in design, construction, maintenance, and closure of any tailings facility over profit. Because what we've seen is that mining companies choose the cheaper solutions over the safer solutions for tailings management, right? So our guidelines, you know, have some very specific mandates around what types of technologies companies should use. So like avoiding the most risky technologies, opting for the safer technologies. We have guidelines around certain pieces of how dams should be constructed. We have guidelines around monitoring. So what type of monitoring system is appropriate? It needs to be adaptable, it needs to be constant, and it needs to respond to changes as they happen. We also have guidelines around, you know, design. So if a tailings dam could affect a human life, it needs to be designed in a certain way that's more protective and safer. And then we have guidelines around how mines should be closed. So companies shouldn't just be walk away from a tailings dam. They need to make sure that they're either monitoring it, that they're monitoring it until the chance of failure has been, you know, reduced or eliminated. So we have a number of guidelines in the document that really try to move away from this mentality of, you know, just reducing the amount spent on tailings and really prioritizing investments in safe technologies and practices.
So clearly, Canada, the US, Australia, South Africa, maybe the UK are old mining countries.
Mm-hmm.
You've got recommendations that touch on our situation. So we've got these old mines that may have another 40 years left in terms of gold, and others that may have, they say 200 in terms of platinum or whatever. Mm-hmm. So do you have recommendations that can fit both situations? New mines, old mines?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, we have recommendations for new mines about how they should be built, and we have recommendations for old mines. I think, you know, we talk about when specific mines should be closed. And like I said, we talk about how they should be closed. And then also, I think, you know, the community piece is across the board, irrespective of whether it's a proposed mine or an operating mine, communities need to be involved in all of that.
Yeah. There you're touching on this oversight and regulatory bodies. I mean, the regulatory bodies here are a shambles. I know in the US, Trump consciously whittled them down. Yeah, they never haven't really started to have teeth, you know. So it's quite important that state regulatory bodies have a clear independent power to investigate and take the necessary actions. They must also be well resourced to do this job. Can we talk a little bit about this?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So there needs to be independence between the regulators and the mining industry. And so oftentimes, you know, what we see in the United States, and I don't know about the context in South Africa, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were similar, that, you know, there's a revolving door between people that worked in the mining industry and then people that are in regulatory bodies that are supposed to be, you know, overseeing the mining industry. And so regulators will go from working for a mining company to working for government, and then maybe back to working for a mining company again after they leave government. And that creates this kind of unhealthy relationship between the industry and the people that are supposed to be overseeing it. So there needs to be that independence. And like you said, there needs to be proper resources for government to truly provide that oversight. Another example in the United States, a lot of times our regulatory bodies are funded by the mining projects that they're overseeing. And so that it obviously creates a whole host of problems there as well. So there needs to be some sort of independent funding stream that's coming from, you know, tax revenues or from the government, other government sources. But then I think one piece of oversight that's also very important is that yes, there needs to be this independent regulation, but mining companies also need to have oversight structures built into the company themselves. And the most important kind of body that's able to do that is the board of directors. So the board of directors really, as the body that's tasked with the fiduciary responsibility of the company, needs to be actively involved in making sure that tailings dams are safe. And so that can be a number of things. That's passing policies, the appropriate policies around tailing safety, approving budgets that ensure that the mine companies dedicating appropriate resources to tailing safety, as well as having people on the board that know things about tailings and know things about disaster and hazard response, so that there's, you know, a check on the staff of the mining company from the board to ensure that the best practices are being followed.
But Jen, you know, in my other life as a unionist, I was impressed with, I think, Canadian law, where health and safety, the CEO was responsible in the corporation. If a worker at the bottom of a pit, something happens, the CEO is responsible. And that level of accountability is really, really important. So I take that point. But we need to try and move on here regarding mine closures and these guys who abscond. I mean, our Auditor General was very critical of our Department of Minerals and Resources here, the DMRE, and saying that they were asleep at the wheel. They've not done this properly. And I just can't understand why a CEO and a board of directors who have sold off a company, have not closed it properly, are probably living off the profits. You can find them. Where's the political will, man? But, you know, can you talk a little bit there? Then we need to start moving towards our closing points.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of pieces. So, and one of them is the need for financial securities around mine closure. So what we see a lot in the United, across the world, in South Africa, but everywhere, is that a lot of times in order to avoid, you know, investing the money in closing the mine, a company will declare bankruptcy or they'll sell to some junior mining company that doesn't have the financial resources.
And in our country, they send it to Black Mining Group and they call it economic empowerment.
Exactly. And what that's really doing is just passing the buck on their financial responsibility to close the mine. So we say in our report that there should be financial assurance for mine closure provided upfront. So that means when a mine gets its permits, it deposits the appropriate amount of money necessary to close the mine in a bank account.
That must be real money, not imaginary.
Exactly. No self-bonding, no self-guarantees, real money in a bank account or a bond that the government can access that if the mining company doesn't close the mine. And that amount needs to be assessed over the life of the mine. It needs to be updated. It needs to account for inflation so that if the company goes bankrupt or disappears at the end of the mine, the local government isn't left with this liability that they don't have the funds or resources to deal with. So that's one really important piece. Another really important piece is that there should be insurance. Mining companies should have public liability insurance over the life of the mine so that that's if something happens, there's some sort of policy to compensate communities or clean up environmental damage. And again, so that it's not the government that's trying to do it because there's a bankrupted mining company. And then I guess, you know, one interesting thing law that we've seen in the United States. I'm not sure if this law exists in other countries or not, is that we have in the state of Montana, they have what's called a bad actor law. So that means that if a mining company doesn't properly close a facility or if there's documentation of them, you know, not taking care of a mine site and absconding on their responsibilities, the corporate executives of that company cannot get another mine permitted in the state.
Right. So it's a blacklisting.
It's a blacklisting, exactly. And so you can't just like bankrupt one company, everybody moves and opens a brand new company with a brand new
delinquent directors, yeah. And then there's some you can have them declared as a delinquent director, yeah.
Exactly.
It's a legal process, yeah. And we need to have it cheaper and more expedited, yeah.
Yeah.
But Are you done with your point? Because I want us to move on.
I was just going to say, I think that's important too, in terms of not letting mining executives move bounce from company to company to avoid responsibility.
Of course, they think they're spreading wealth and prosperity, you know. In fact, we see them spreading harm and danger and risk. But anyhow, I would like, before we talk about, where the tailings management should go next, what are the big issues that should be undertaken to move us forward? I've shared in the chat the Sibanye Stillwater group. If you want to share that as a slide, and maybe let's just talk to see concretely in South Africa how some of these principles we've discussed may become applicable. Sibanye Stillwater, people know, you can share them if you want, is the company that bought over Lonmin, who were responsible for the Marikana massacre, where at the end of the day, 44 workers died, 34 by police, and the others by some means. Could you talk me through this? Because for the uninitiated, it looks beautiful. It's transparent. It's on a website. You can find it. And, so there's some level. They deserve some points, right? And I don't know if the transparency is deep and sufficient enough, or how activists, community mining activists, could use this, because I don't know whether they include it yet. Could you just add any points?
Sure. So just, to say before we start that I'm not particularly familiar with this company. I know a little bit about its mines in South Africa, a little bit about its mine in Montana in the United States. So I have the basics, but again, I haven't done a deep dive into this, so I'm not, familiar. But I guess, just looking at this and thinking about a couple of things that stand out to me. One is that, the company is really committing to the global industry standard on tailings management, which we discussed as that standard that
we know its shortcomings.
That didn't go far enough. So, I think on the one hand, they're trying to promote their adherence to the standard, but we know that that standard really doesn't go far enough in terms of community protection and environmental protection. Another piece that kind of stood out to me is that they talk about how all of the facilities in South Africa are used during used with the upstream dam construction method. And like we just spoke about, we say in Safety First that should be banned and all upstream dams should be closed. So that's one kind of red flag right there that I would look to. And then I would like to see more on here too, particularly about how they're accounting for climate change in their tailings facilities. A great example being there was extreme flooding in Montana the last couple of weeks. And the Sibanye Stillwater actually had to close one of their mines because the access roads to the mine had been washed out. So it's in a place where there has been extreme climate changes. And I would like to see on their website for transparency and more information about how they're accounting for climate change in their
mind. I would like to add the issue about community participation and consent. I mean, it looks like communities don't feature in here. It's just done by their experts. Mm-hmm. What about the experts in those principles that we spoke about earlier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point. It would be really good to see how communities are consulted, how much information they're given. And also, are there documents being reviewed by independent experts?
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to be any role for the DMRE that this report has been sent to them, or, there need to be some other arbiter, because corporations are good at corporate spin as well, and of course, we know our department is not that strong, but at least this third party, there must be reports sent to it, or to say this has been sent to them, I guess, But anyhow, I think we're just touching in here to try and show activists how best they could apply these principles. But let's end off by looking at what is to be done in this movement. Where should the movement go? How do tailings become a focal point? How are they managed? How do they become on the agenda and change for the better? To improve people's lives, or at least stop people from getting harmed.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to acknowledge, and something that we try to highlight in the report, is that the safest tailings facility is the one that isn't built, right? So permanent above ground storage of tailings should really be the last resort. Like, we need to look for ways to reduce mining, to reduce new virgin mining, particularly creating new mines. And we need to look for ways to reduce the waste that's created at the mine site. And it's really important that as a society, and particularly countries in the global north, like where I sit, is that we need to identify ways to actively reduce our dependence on metals. And so that means thinking about how we structure our cities in terms of creating more access to public transportation, less dependency on cars, moving away from, you know, the dependency on single car ownership or single family vehicle ownership. And then also looking at ways that we are designing products to be recycled so that we can recapture materials from electric vehicle batteries, for example, or lithium batteries. And then, you know, moving towards more circular economy solutions so that we're not just consuming, building new mines, creating more waste. We really need to move away from that model first.
That's why I like the idea of the North-South Civil Society Partnership. I'm not to say, I mean, that you guys are obese or, you know, but clearly the major consumers are there and, you know, the US in particular, you know, and we need to try and find this balance. And of course, in our own country, the middle classes are the bigger consumers and the poor get nothing. So, and they bear the brunt of the bad air, the pollution, the suffering, the waste, you know, so clearly, we need a better solution than what has been offered. And I think that this report makes a great step forward. Our next challenge is, of course, to take it to them by building national campaigns, continental campaigns. And maybe, you know, when they try to have a jamboree in their annual mining indaba in Cape Town, we should take this to them to negotiate with them. Not that they come and speak to civil society and take over civil society meetings, but we tell them in these areas, these are the following tailing dams that you have failed to act in line with your principles, which are low, and worse still with ours, which are higher. Are there any last words you want to say to any?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just kind of reflecting on that, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done and that as civil society, we can do to push for better international oversight. Right now, there's discussions around forming a global tailings management institute that would be housed at the UN. And the efforts are being led by the UN and investors. I think it's really important and critical that body is a multi-stakeholder body that gives power, especially decision-making power, to communities, to workers, to frontline.
I would say it'd be multi-stakeholder or not at all, because exactly. The bosses have their own forums already.
Exactly. And we don't need another corrupted industry run institute. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I think, you know, I think there's work that could be done and that institute could be a resource both for communities and for governments in ways to improve their regulation. Because like we've talked about, we know that regulation is the best way to improve safety. And so that is a really critical step that really needs to happen moving forward.
Yeah. And you know, where can people get these documents? I mean, the Benchmarks Foundation will have it on their website. I'm sure it's on the Earthworks, Mining World Canada.
Yeah, it's if you go to earthworks.org/safety-first, the full report is there. We also have like a summary table of the guidelines because the report's, you know, 50 pages. So it's a bit to read through, but we've got a summary table of it. We have some graphics and we're also in the process of creating materials that are, you know, like supplemental materials that can be more useful to kind of day-to-day work or day-to-day advocacy. And we have, the original report was translated into Portuguese, Spanish, and Indonesian. We're currently working to translate the updated version to those three languages, as well as French and Turkish. So those will all be up on our website too, once they're translated and ready.
That's great. Truly international effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day, and we're going to have a great evening.
Yes, exactly. Talk to you soon.